COP26 has finally come to an end. We can only hope the agreements reached are going to spare us from the Anthropocene Armageddon, but the effects of global climate change are already being felt around the world, including in the Nordic countries. Rising tides, more rain, forest fires, storms of increasing intensity and frequency, and landslides. The region is having to face all of this as the climate becomes more extreme and less predictable. We've teamed up with the Nordic Council of Ministers for five more special editions of the Foreign Desk Explainer, part of an occasional ongoing series delving deeper into topics of global importance from the region. This series is focusing on sustainability issues in the run-up to, during and after COP26 in Glasgow. We'll be looking at things like how the Nordic countries are trying to eat more sustainably, decarbonise industry, and the subject of this episode, preparing for the consequences of climate change. What are the most deadly threats to life from climate change in the Nordics? What is Sweden learning from Canada's forest fires? And how has Gothenburg become the European capital of rain?
This fire here may not be as unusual as we thought it was this time.
Risk is a natural thing. Risk is part of our life.
So it's not about adapting in the future. We already have to adapt now.
People up here in the Nordic countries do often joke that global warming might be a good thing. Things are going to get warmer, right? And who would complain about better weather in a region not overly blessed with sun and warmth? But of course, climate change is not just about things getting warmer. The global temperature increases are already having a negative, sometimes catastrophic impact. But there will be some winners and some losers, or at least some won't be as badly affected as others, even within the Nordic region. According to a new international ranking, the Notre Dame Global Adaptation Index, from the US University of the same name, featuring 181 countries, Denmark is the country in the world that is least vulnerable to the results of climate change. Norway, too, does well in the list, coming in second, despite several fatal landslides in recent years. So that's Denmark and Norway, but in this episode we're going to focus on the parts of the Nordic region which are already facing serious problems. My name is Michael Booth. I'm Monocle's man in Denmark and the author of a book about the Nordic region, The Almost Nearly Perfect People. In the wake of COP26, for this special edition of the Foreign Desk Explainer, in association with the Nordic Council of Ministers, we're going to take a look at the impact of climate change here in the north. We start in Sweden, which has experienced some of the worst forest fires in its history in recent years. Reporter Richard Orange ventured into the danger zone of a badly charred forest to find out more.
Many of the trees still standing here, but they are burned, as you can see. And if we go further in the burned forest, there's a big risk that the trees can fall down on us. So we make a stop here.
Dan Sundström has taken me to the site of what was the worst forest fire anywhere in Sweden this summer, in Finnsjö, near the city of Kalmar. After 20 years as a fireman, Sundström was the person responsible for coordinating between the local rescue services battling to put out the blaze and the national authorities. Can you just describe what you see and what that tells you about how the fire was?
What I can see is that the fire has been quite high up in the trees in some places, which means there has been actual flames here. Many fires like this, it goes flames by the ground. And you can see some of the trees are totally burned out, which means that those great flames, they create a massive heat that makes the fire spread even faster than on a dry ground during summer. So with the wind that was, or those days this fire was ongoing, it of course make the fire spread very fast, and that is why it got so big. It's almost impossible for the ground crew to catch up with the fire.
How did you first hear about the fire?
We are not the ones first on the site. That's the local fire departments, and they are very good at being the first one on the site. We get the call when they need some more, like helicopters, aircraft. This started on a Friday, I think, and I heard about it on the Saturday morning.
In the summer of 2018, Sweden saw the worst forest fires in its history, following an unusually long heat wave. According to Sundström, the lessons learned made a huge difference this year.
The reinforcement that government could offer the local fire departments has been improved in a great way. The authority called Civil Contingency and Agency.
Civil Contingencies Agency.
Yeah. MSB, we say here. They have done a great job by making agreements with helicopter companies, and they also actually bought airplanes that can drop water on the fire. Those reinforcements wasn't agreed on in 2018, but they got it. But this year it was much easier because they were on call.
And what difference did the helicopters make to how bad a fire this was?
The helicopters that can drop a big amount of water, mainly on the front of the fire to slow it down, they are crucial. Without them, the fire can continue spreading. So they, by time, by dropping water on the front, the ground crew can catch up with the fire.
Sweden's authorities have also brought in a new system, which means that all local fire departments need to share an inventory of their equipment and staff, so that their resources can be shared in an emergency. They also need to pre-plan how they will coordinate. This meant the Finnsjö fire could be stopped much more rapidly.
There were fire departments here from, in fact, all south of Sweden, all the way from Gothenburg down to Skåne County. They had also reinforcements from groups of volunteers. They had a small part of the military. So there was a lot of people here struggling to put out this fire.
It's not only the emergency services that need to adapt to a higher risk of fires. On the way out to meet Sundström, I stop off in Växjö at the offices of Södra, the forestry cooperative that manages much of the forest in southern Sweden. I ask Patrick Andersson, a senior expert on harvesting, what measures the forest industry is taking.
The things that we are doing most is try to take away the risk of starting fires. So what we do in that is to limit the amount of sparks that we make, because we're using metal tracks on the machines to prevent soil damage. So during summer, when it's very dry, we take away the tracks. We could have a fire guard that has equipment to take out fires. When it's higher risk of forest fires, we can take a break then. So we work more in the mornings and a little bit later in the evening when the risk is lower.
And when you're looking at preventing forest fires, do you look at what's done in other countries like California, where they have a longer history of forest fires?
Mainly what we have been looking at, and also this model we are using for predicting the risk of fires, is a Canadian model called Fire Weather Index, but has adapted to Swedish circumstances. So we are mainly looking at Canada, how we are doing, because also their forests that we have in Canada are more comparable to the Swedish forest, a little bit different type of tree species in California and so on.
Are there any other things that you haven't put in place yet that are under consideration?
The Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm, they are looking into using satellites. We have seen in some other countries, for Germany, for example, they have put out cameras in the forest to find fires. But for us, we think Sweden is too large a country. We will need so many cameras, but it will not be cost efficient. So we think satellite could be the idea to find it.
Back at the charred forest in Finnsjö, I asked Sundström to what extent he expects forest fires to get worse in southern Sweden in the future.
This fire here may not be as unusual as we thought it was this time. Maybe we will see this rapid spreading of the fire. That is the main difference from earlier years. Many people think that, oh, today it's 32 plus Celsius, there's a big risk for fire. Yeah, that's right. But if there also is a high humidity in the air, then you can start a fire, but the spreading will not be that rapid. But when you go to a humidity, like in this case, when this fire started, it's below 30, then you have an extreme spreading on the fire. And that I think we will see more of further on.
That was Richard Orange reporting from southern Sweden. I've been lucky enough to visit the Faroe Islands, a spectacular place rightly called the Hawaii of the North. I went in winter. It was incredibly windy, I remember, but apparently things are only going to get worse in that regard, as I found out from Rico Kongsager, associate professor at Copenhagen University, who's the project leader of ClickNord, based out of the university, looking at the impact of climate change on rural and remote communities in the Nordic countries.
So we have two cases in Sweden, two cases in Norway, one on Iceland, and we have two in Denmark and one on the Faroe Islands. And it's different hazards for all the cases we have. So it's something about wildfires and flash floods and avalanches and storms and flooding from the sea and so on. We are mainly interested in small, rural, remote communities. Bigger cities, they will adapt easily. because the money is easier to get to in those places. But on the outskirts, in small rural communities, it's going to be difficult to protect some of these places.
Are we seeing an impact yet, and how serious is it?
The most of these communities in the Nordic, they are affected by climate change now. It's clearly that we get a larger volume of precipitation and we also have stronger winds. It's causing flash floods, it's causing landslides. Increasing temperature will increase the amount of avalanches that we have in the higher mountains. We also see a larger frequency and also intensity of the storms. What used to be 100-year events is now 20-year events. And we can see, for instance, last year in Denmark in January, we had 3 20-year winds. So it's not about adapting in the future. We already have to adapt now.
If we manage to keep the temperature increased to 1.5 degrees, how worried are you? And if it goes beyond that, are you panicking?
I guess as a researcher, it's not my job to panic, but of course I can look into the data and the statistics, and I cannot really understand if there's somebody that are talking about not doing much.
You've just been in the Faroes, which is pretty much entirely small communities. I've visited islands in the Faroes where there's just a family of five living, for example. What are the specific challenges to the Faroes?
When you are in small communities, for instance, on the Faroe Islands, there are some places where the emergencies won't go. For instance, there was a emergency director that told me last week that he was not going on certain roads, and there's some of these roads are the only access to some of the communities. It's not really possible to get any access to these communities during a storm. The wind speeds are simply too high on some of the roads because they are very close to the sea, so the wind speed will take vehicles off the road. Even when they are driving a 10-ton fire truck, they simply don't dare to drive it on certain roads, and then it's almost impossible to have any access to some of these communities. What we're also looking into in the project is what we call place attachment. People are attached to some communities in regard to that they really don't want to live anywhere else.
And the climate change factor in terms of the Faroes is the change in the Gulf Stream.
The ice is melting on, for instance, on Greenland, on the North Pole. So the level of salt in the water is changing. And that's why we see a change in the Gulf Stream. And that will affect these storms as well. So we can have a low pressure over the Faroe Islands. And that will cause a storm for several days. But it will also be more severe in regard to what we normally see.
Do you think people in the Nordics are aware enough that they're vulnerable?
So some of them are quite reluctant in regard to admitting that they know that things are changing, so they don't really want to talk about it. And in other places, they are quite aware of it. And we, for instance, see it on the Faroe Islands. They are quite used to storms, so they see the next storm as the last storm, and it's going to be of the same intensity and so on. And it might not be the first 10 storms and might not be the first 10 years that we will experience very damaging storm, but there can, at one time, there will just be one very strong storm. And we can see that also in the statistics, not only from the storms, but also from the sea level.
Do you have any sense of how much money is being spent in this part of the world on climate change preparedness?
20 years back, there was spent maybe 99% of the money spent on climate change were put into climate change mitigation. At that time, it was only 1% that was spent on adaptation. That's have changed during the last year. So we are around 15-20% now globally. The problem is that we are saying that it's going to be very, very expensive to do something in regard to mitigating climate change, to put up windmills and so on. But it's going to be extremely expensive also not to do anything.
People in the Nordics even joke about it and say, you bring it on. It'll be warmer. That'll be great.
Yes, some might be happy about the change. And in some places, we are also talking about winners and losers. It's been told for way too long that climate change is only a loser's game. But it's not only a loser's game. It's also a winner's game. We can change how we live and adapt, of course, to a future climate. It could be that we are some places we should not live. But we can also see that we can move other places and actually win something from a changing climate. In the Nordics, it's mainly going to be, for instance, the farmers in some places, if they can adapt. And we can also develop agricultural land further north.
That was Professor Rico Kongsayer of Klick Nord, a project looking at how small rural communities are facing the impact of climate change. Another project within Klick Nord is looking at the impact of climate change in Iceland. I spoke to the person in charge, Uta Reichardt, of the University of Iceland's Institute of Sustainability Studies.
I focus on disaster risk research and, in particular, the way in which people and communities cope with disastrous events. I'm also very aware that everything is interlinked. All natural hazards are some sort of human-based.
Except for volcanoes, I guess. So Iceland has more than its fair share of natural hazards. But
well, I do want to say that even the issue with volcanic activity, to a certain extent, is related to our climate. There has been research published a few years ago about the increase of volcanic activity due to climate change. You have the pressure from glaciers on the land, and if that gets lifted, because the volume of glaciers decreases, it's a bit like a cork that pops. It's assumed that it contributes to increased volcanic activity.
Gosh, I didn't know that.
It's a theory. It's what people have been observing, not in all places, but in a place like Iceland. That is something that people assume is going to happen because our population is much lower than in other countries. Population density is much lower. So a lot of times these events happen in places that are scarcely, if at all, populated. And if you look at the latest eruption that we have an hour away from Reykjavik, it's the perfect natural event that people really enjoy.
A spectator event, right?
Yeah, it's an easy access. People like to go for a walk, watch the eruption, watch the lava, and just gaze at nature.
Who needs Netflix when you live in Iceland? Can you maybe briefly give an overview of the other challenges and threats from climate change?
So what we are looking at in particular is remote coastal communities and climate change. So again, if you look at the landscape in Iceland, you have a lot of communities that are at the coastlines of Iceland with, you know, accessibility to water and fisheries. And a lot of those communities have water on the one side and then an exposure to a steep hill on the other side. And what comes with that is the risk of avalanches or mudslides. So that is, of course, something that with changing climate also changes in frequency and the extent to which it threatens communities. So it's something that has always existed and that communities in Iceland have always witnessed. But we are looking at how that is changing with regards to the changing climate and what people do about it.
How is it changing?
We can see that there is a change in composition when it comes to avalanches, for example. The way in which temperatures influence the composition of an avalanche is that it gets a bit wetter, and that then expresses itself in the way the avalanches come down.
And you're seeing those changes over what kind of timescale, and how great are the changes?
Well, that's a really good question, because of course, again, as I said, it's something that has always happened. And it's a question of what if it is climate change related and what if it is a natural frequency. Right now, of course, you're looking at single events and you're trying to connect them together. It's still a process that we are observing. Another thing is, though, with thawing permafrost, you see mudslides going down. And one of the biggest mudslides that went down was December 2020. That when we had an event in Seyðisfjörður, a community in the east of Iceland, and that was the biggest mudslide ever to hit an urban area in Iceland. And in the same year, January 2020, we had a massive avalanche in a place called Flateyri in the Westfjords, northwest of Iceland. There, for example, the avalanche went down in a volume that was maybe one of the worst case scenarios.
Is it difficult to get the message through to people who are really used to dealing with extreme weather and extreme climate?
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting point that you're making in terms of risk perception and awareness, that from the outside, we're very quick to see locations only in the moment when something happens, and then are very quick to ask, well, why do you live there anyway? Why do you expose yourself to such a risk? I think what we often in awareness fail to see is that the life that is happening between those events, that we don't only reduce communities to the risks that they are facing, but also see all the opportunities that come with living in a place like that. Why do people live in places that are exposed to hazards anyway, and maybe even more so in the age of climate change.
What's the answer to that?
That's exactly what we want to find out. But from what we've gathered so far, risk is a natural thing. Risk is part of our life. And in living, we take risks, and we take them because there's a trade-off. There is something that we gain from it. What people in those communities, like anywhere else, have is very often a social network, family roots, historic roots in terms of either having lived there for generations, they have their social network there, they have their income there. And they, again, they see it as something that is just part of life there. Not to say that people are looking for the thrill of being exposed to avalanches, but for them, living in a place like that is much more than that. While, again, for us, we often only put our focus on these communities when something happens. And the other way around, you know, they look at people living in the capital and ask themselves, how can you possibly expose yourself to the risks that you have in capital areas? The risks of being hit by traffic, probably often, you know, certain limitation and quality of life.
And we know who made the right decision in COVID time.
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, the Icelanders, to put it bluntly, have a very high tolerance for risk in general, don't they? I don't like to generalize about population, but when the population is only 350,000 people, you can risk a little bit of generalization, and they're pretty open to risk.
I think they have a specific way of accepting nature.
Is the government taking this seriously in Iceland? How are they facing these issues you're highlighting, and how much money is being spent on it, on preparedness?
I think more and more money is being spent on preparedness and management and education. We had a couple of years ago a eulogy for a glacier that had to give up his title of being a glacier. So yeah, the glacial mass in Iceland is decreasing. Overall, you see that the temperature change in Iceland is higher than the average temperature change. Iceland is highly dependent on tourism, and tourists come here also for the glaciers. So in the short term, there's probably more tourism for people that still want to see this kind of phenomena. But of course, in the long term, that's a very big threat to tourism industry.
That was Uta Reichard of Iceland University and the Click Nord project. Having heard at the beginning of the programme about Sweden's increasing struggles with forest fires, it's perhaps a little paradoxical that our correspondent in Sweden, Richard Orange, should return now at the end of our programme with a report from the country about too much water. But in Sweden's second city, Gothenburg, they're learning to see the increasing rainfall as a plus.
Hello!
Hello, Richard! What a brilliant day!
Hello, I'm Jens, in rainy Gothenburg.
It is extremely rainy. My trousers have been soaked through in the short walk from the station. And if the artist and designer Jens Toms Iversen doesn't seem too unhappy about the downpour, that's because of his unusual job. Jens is employed by the city's water and sewage department to front Rain Gothenburg, a project that looks at creative ways to turn the city's rain into an asset.
I take it this isn't an average day. This is more rainy than normal.
It is a bit like normal, but of course this is intense. But actually this is, you know, when you talk about 100-year rain, you talk about 30-year rain. This is maybe 0.5-year rain. Honestly, this is almost nothing compared to when it rains really heavy. And it's not the thing that Gothenburg is the most rainy city, but we get our fair share. We have about a third of the year, a little bit more, when it's raining. So we're thinking, what if we turn that into an asset and made those days even better? You know, when it's sunny and nice, everyone is happy already. Right now we are at the Näckrosdammen. It's the first rain playground that was built here in Gothenburg.
The playground has giant lily pads that both provide shelter for parents and channel water into pods where children can play with it. And it has dips cast into the ground to collect water as puddles.
Usually what you want in a playground is that you want the water to go away so it doesn't make any puddles. But, you know, if you ask any kid, is it fun to jump in a puddle? Yes, it is. So here it's created already, so the water actually stays at some places, so they can jump as much as they want. Everything here is made so this playground is more fun to be when it is raining.
But managing the rain in Gothenburg isn't just about fun. Playgrounds like Nekrosdammen will be crucial for preventing flooding in the city as the climate gets wetter still. As I find out when I meet another, somewhat more conventional city official, a short rain-soaked walk away.
My name is Lisa Ekström. I work at the city planning office with climate adaptation measures. Now we're in the middle of Gothenburg at Heden. It's today, there are a lot of parking lots and soccer fields, and it's a very big open space today. And it's a bit low comparing to the surroundings. So if a heavy rainfall would hit the city, at some places here, because it's low-lying, it will be quite deep water. And we want to develop this area with both residential houses and working places. And then we have to make space for the water as well. In the future, what we see is that we can get more rain, more heavy rainfalls, more intense rain, and more volume that we have to handle in the city.
What damage could that do?
Could both damage buildings that we have today and also the new buildings that we're planning. We have to see that we can build them in a good way so they do not get damaged when a heavy rainfall hits the city.
You think we could have people, it could threaten people's lives like we've seen some places in Europe this summer?
Yeah, maybe. Hopefully not, but maybe.
And what kind of infrastructure could you use and how would that work if there is massively heavy rainfall?
There's a big competition of the open areas in the city. So when we plan the area, we have to use multifunctional areas where you can plan for different functions at the same spot. So maybe you can handle water in the park or water at the playground or at the soccer field. Then you can use like the soccer field playing soccer like almost every day, but when the heavy rainfall comes, then the water gathers there and it can stay there for 1 or 2 days. And then when it's there's space in the pipe systems, it can run off the pipe systems from the area. We have been studying other countries how to handle the water, and Copenhagen has a lot of good examples how to use multifunctional areas for handling the water, and the Netherlands and other countries in Europe.
As well as parks designed for flooding, what city planners call blue-green infrastructure, Gothenburg also last year started work on a new seawall designed to protect the city against rising sea levels. But that risks shutting floods inside the city if there is a sudden cloud burst.
So you need to have some openings in the wall that the water can run through when it rains. And then during the winter time, you close these openings, so it's protecting from sea level rise and high levels in the stream. And in the summertime, where you can expect heavy rainfalls, the opening's going to be opened.
Back at Nekrosdammen, Jens says an important part of his job is to work with engineers and planning officials like Lisa on combating climate change.
But my job is that hopefully work together with those people from early on in the projects, because they are focused on one thing only, that's solving a problem in a technical way, and they are really good at that. But they don't think about the human part of it and maybe aesthetics and other values, cultural values and so on. So we are thinking that we have to do those things anyway from a climate point of view. We have to deal with the rain in a much more clever way. But at the same time, we can use that. Why not do it and add just a little bit more creativity to it?
Richard Orange in a very rainy Gothenburg for Monocle.
That's all for this week's special episode of the Foreign Desk Explainer. Listen out for more of these editions produced by me, Michael Booth, in association with the Nordic Council of Ministers. It was edited by the Monocle 24 team in London. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.